This is the first day of Hamid Karzai's second term as president of Afghanistan, and some say he's tainted by 5 years of corruption. Some people call me a bad apple. Or maybe it's not Karzai himself, but the company he keeps.
I think the President Karzai is doing an okay job, but the problem is with his cabinet. They're a bunch of thieves. They steal everything they can.
Who's the bad apple in the Afghanistan bushel? And is it too late to remove it? Is the government rotten to the core? Finding the bad fruit on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 19th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. You heard John there, actually the voice of a man in a bus station in Kabul.
Very disillusioned sounding.
Right, talking about his new old president, Hamid Karzai. And we're going to be talking more about the disconnect between what Hamid Karzai says and what the Afghan people hear in just a moment.
Good morning. And also on the program, the audacity of the Obama administration. How does governing stack up to campaigning and winning? We're going to discuss that with David Plouffe, the Obama campaign manager. And retailers try scarcity to raise prices. And what about digital immortality? Is it a problem that some files never die? You bet.
But first, Anand Gopal from The Wall Street Journal joins us from Kabul. Good morning, Anand. This inauguration, oddly, took place behind closed doors in a fortified, almost bunker, very secret, very tight security. And you ended up watching it on television. Did that seem like a crazy situation to you?
It does, but in many ways it's fitting with how things have been going here the last few months. I mean, the levels of violence have been very high. Today on the streets, the city is on complete lockdown. Cars weren't allowed to move anywhere. There's almost no pedestrians on the streets. And the government is very concerned about any sort of Taliban attacks today because it would have a high symbolic value on the day that Karzai is getting inaugurated.
So how are the Afghans feeling about this day? Is this a day of celebration, or is it just another day? Are they just worried?
Well, it's certainly not a day of celebration. I think a lot of Afghans feel that it's a big inconvenience because, as I said, most people can't leave their houses today. There's checkpoints and barricades all over the city. People are forced to stay inside their homes. And it certainly isn't the sort of scene you'd expect from an inauguration ceremony with Karzai supporters cheering. None of that's happening. Everything's behind closed doors in a very fortified palace.
Well, it's certainly a sharp contrast between his first inauguration in 2004. Anand Gopal, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
The stage is now set in the Senate after Majority Leader Harry Reid unveiled his version of the health care reform bill last night. The proposal expands coverage to millions, has a public option, and as Reid says,
we're not going to add a dime to the deficit. In fact, quite the opposite. We'll cut the problems we have with money around here by as much as $750 billion.
Now, there is a price tag, though, nearly $850 billion over 10 years. Federal court has found the Army Corps of Engineers liable for the catastrophic flooding in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. The ruling says the Army engineers were negligent in their maintenance of the levees.
Attorney General Eric Holder went to Capitol Hill yesterday to justify his decision to try suspected 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a civilian court in New York. Republican Senator John Kyle had this question for him.
How could you be more likely to get a conviction in federal court when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is already asked to plead guilty before military commission and be executed?
Holder had an answer.
He will not select the prosecution venue. I will select it, and I have.
In Wall Street, the Dow's going to open just above 10,400 today. The S&P still hovering right around 1,100, and the NASDAQ just below 2,200. We're asking you the question that Stephen Dubner posed to
Karzai
us.
Karzai has this problem.
I was just about to make that comparison. Is what you say different than what you do, and which is a more accurate measure of you as a person? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, all about Hamid Karzai and his second inauguration. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Aga muhim zaka dekana uchus dawlat chide
The voice of Hamid Karzai on his inauguration day. Karzai has just been sworn in this morning as the Afghan president for his second five-year term. That comes after a long election fraught with allegations of corruption. We're joined again by Anand Gopal, a Wall Street Journal reporter in Kabul, where the Afghan capital has actually been on lockdown, fears of attacks on this inauguration day. Good morning again, Anand.
Thanks for having me.
Can you explain, were there any actual threats against Karzai that made them fear there could be an attack on his inauguration day?
Well, there were no specific threats against Karzai, but there was a high level of threats in general. Anytime there's been a major event like this, there's been attacks or attempted attacks. And in fact, this morning there were a few isolated incidents in various parts of the city. But for example, in the run-up to the elections, there was major attacks every single day. And there's a lot of concern that sort of thing would be repeated.
You were saying that it would be symbolically disastrous if there was to be an attack on Karzai's inauguration day. But symbolically, it can't be great for him to be going through this ceremony behind fortified walls under tight security where everyone who is interested has to watch it on a TV screen.
It certainly isn't. This is probably the better of the two bad options here. But it shows to a lot of Afghans that a lot of what's happening within the palace, the inauguration and everything associated with that is really disconnected with the reality on the ground in the city of Kabul or in the rest of the country.
And do the Afghans see this as the beginning of a new tenure for Karzai? I mean, he's promised to turn around his government and pursue corruption. Do Afghans see this as a new day or just the continuation of what they've had for the past 5 years?
They see it mostly as a continuation of what they've had. We've seen a lot of cynicism on the part of Afghans recently. A lot of the hope that Afghans have had in the first few years after 2001 has mostly been eroded now. And it's because politicians here have made a lot of promises. There's been a lot of people saying they want to clamp corruption and bring security, but they haven't seen that happen. So I think a lot of Afghans are taking a wait-and-see approach.
Okay, Anand Gopal joins us from Kabul. He's with the Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much. Transparency International's recent corruption index put Afghanistan as the world's second most corrupt country. Somalia's number one. That's a drop down to second. Well, actually, a lift from fifth place last year. The international community has been putting a huge amount of pressure on Karzai to change the corruption in his government. And here's Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton this weekend.
I've made it clear that we're not going to be providing any civilian aid to Afghanistan unless we have a certification that if it goes into the Afghan government in any form, that we're going to have ministries that we can hold accountable.
The newly reelected President Hamid Karzai addressed corruption directly in his address, in his inaugural address today. He specifically said he would find any officials in his government who were corrupt and he would prosecute them within the realms of the law. We're joined now by Isabel Coleman, senior fellow of U.S. foreign policy at the Council of Foreign Relations. Good morning, Isabel.
Good morning, Celeste.
So you heard Hillary Clinton's strong words about not offering any civilian aid to Afghanistan until corruption is handled. Is that an empty threat?
Well, I wouldn't say it's an empty threat, but it's a limited threat. I mean, the fact is that civilian aid goes along with our military engagement there, and we do already have a lot of troops in Afghanistan. We are contemplating, as everyone knows, sending more, and it would really be cutting off our nose to spite our face if we pulled out all civilian aid because we couldn't tolerate corruption in that country.
So break it down for me. There's several things that we spend money on in Afghanistan. We send a lot of money to NGOs, non-governmental organizations. We send money to the Afghan government to help them get through many of their processes and their regular day-to-day workings. And there's also the military spending, as you were saying. Can these three things be separated? Could we, for example, not send money to government offices but still fund military operations and still fund NGOs?
Yes, we could. The fact is that the overwhelming bulk of the money does go to military operations, overwhelmingly so, and that will continue. And much of that is for training the Afghan National Army and police, and we're ramping that up at a pretty big rate. In addition, you know, we give the international community provides 90%. Of the funds that the Afghan government spends. So we are, in effect, bankrolling the Afghan government. We, the international community, and the U.S. provides about a third of that. And we provide money to NGOs, but that's a much, much smaller number. First of all, there are not that many NGOs operating in Afghanistan. Many of them have left in recent years over security concerns. And the ones that remain have found their operations quite constrained because of concerns about security, so they're operating really just in major cities.
Do you believe Hamid Karzai when he pledges to find any corrupt officials in his government and prosecute them to the full extent of the law?
I think he's going to make some changes, and he'll pick out the low-hanging fruit. And he has made some changes already. I mean, he has switched out some ministers with U.S. pressure along the way over the last 18 months. Now the Minister of the Interior is Mohammed Atmar, who is widely recognized as a very competent and non-corrupt person. And he, as Minister of Interior, does oversee a lot of the one of the bigger Afghan budgets, because it's responsible for a lot of the road building and infrastructure that's going on. Will he actually take down some of the well-known drug traffickers who are in his government? I mean, there are different levels of corruption here, and he has not done that, and I'm not holding my breath that he will.
And it seems the incentives are all in the other direction, Isabel, and the certification process that Hillary Clinton describes didn't work in El Salvador during the Reagan administration. How can it work now? With Karzai so relatively powerless, it seems to me the ethnic tensions in Afghanistan force him to pay off people that he might have not had to deal with 5 years ago.
Well, that's exactly true. And the run-up to the election, you know, he brought a number of unsavory characters from the fringes back right into the center as part of his government. And that, I think, is what's fueling the previous comment about people feeling really disillusioned. So these people, you know, what campaign promises were made, we don't really know, but clearly some were to help him get reelected. He felt he needed to make those bargains, and they would be very difficult to undo at this point.
It sounds like the takeaway here is that Hamid Karzai is caught between the rock of international pressure and the hard place of a culture of corruption in Afghanistan. That's Isabel Coleman, Senior Fellow of U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council of Foreign Relations. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check on news stories now.
Senate Democrats unveiled their version of a health care reform bill last night. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin says his party has produced a milestone piece of legislation.
If you could have been in our caucus this evening and watch the reaction of the Democratic senators as Senator Reid presented this bill, I think you would have felt as we did. This is a great moment in history, and we're proud to be part of it.
According to the Congressional Budget Office, the price tag for this plan comes in at nearly $850 billion over 10 years, and in the Senate over many weeks, it's going to get a rewrite. NATO says U.S. service members, two of them, have been killed in an explosion in southern Afghanistan. The deaths occurred on the same day as the inauguration of President Hamid Karzai, who said Afghanistan will control its own security within 5 years.
President Obama is heading back to Washington after his Asian tour. Before leaving South Korea, he confirmed the U.S. will send a special envoy to North Korea in December. And sticking with North Korea, here's a little piece of information we found for you. North Korea has told its citizens to keep their hair short and tidy. A leading state-run newspaper says men who trim their hair look elegant, ambitious, and passionate. And for women, they recommend buns, permanents, and braids, saying long, messy hair does not suit what it calls the people of the revolutionary age.
Some little advice from dear leader.
I'm going to have to keep checking in on your haircut, John. Let's look at some of the stories that we're watching.
That's
this
directed
morning.
At me? From the North Korean leader?
Should you be considering a trip to North Korea, you might have to get your hair trimmed a little more often.
We can usually find an appointment.
So you can
Madison
look elegant,
Avenue.
Ambitious,
yes.
And
right.
Passionate.
Right.
Coming up, we're going to talk to Todd Zwillick about the Attorney General Eric Holder and what he had to say to some tough questions on Capitol Hill about trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Yeah, let's get some takeout. Yeah.
takeouts on news, absolutely. We're going to go first to Washington. Attorney General Eric Holder was on Capitol Hill yesterday answering some questions, from senators in the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was mostly defending his decision to try the alleged mastermind of the September 11th attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in a civilian court in New York City. So Todd Zwillick was there. Todd, what was Congress most interested in finding out about?
Hi, Celeste. Good morning. Well, what they really wanted to know, especially Republicans, is why a civilian trial? We have a military tribunal system. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's been held at a military installation for 8 years since 9/11. Why a criminal trial in New York? And they weren't the only ones with that question. There was an interesting moment after this hearing. A woman named Alice Hoagland, who's a retired flight attendant from California, her son, Mark Bingham, was killed on Flight 93. She confronted Attorney General Eric Holder after the hearing to say she didn't know why this trial had to be moved to New York in a civilian trial. It was a very, very interesting exchange. I got it on tape and I want to listen to it here. Holder's basically saying, there's things I know about the evidence that you don't know that make it the best decision, but I can't tell you why. Listen to this.
I am not a bit sure that this move is anything that's going to be a healing.
I responded to one of the last questions. This is almost a trust me thing, I suppose, but there are reasons why bringing this case in an Article III court, when it comes to the admissibility of certain evidence, is really the right way to go and really maximizes our chances of getting a successful outcome.
Okay. We'll defer judgment.
Okay, well, she may be
great
ready
job,
to
Todd.
Defer judgment, and she may be willing to trust Eric Holder, but I can't imagine that the Republicans are willing to do that.
No, you're right. Republicans aren't happy about this at all. You hit it on the head, Celeste. They have some real big questions about a civilian criminal trial. You know, people who have criminal trials in the United States have rights. And the questions Republicans have are, hey, Attorney General, what if there's a mistrial? What if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is acquitted? What if a judge orders him let go? What are you going to do if a judge orders him to be let go? The Attorney General's decision, his response to that at first was, I can't foresee a scenario where he wouldn't be acquitted. I've told my prosecutors that failure's not an option. We will never let him go. He won't be acquitted. Senator John Cornyn of Texas said, I hope you're right.
Okay, thanks, Todd. That's Todd, our takeaway Washington correspondent.
And, of course, he has pleaded. We expect him to plead guilty, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Todd Zwillick.
So, yeah, Todd Zwillick is always pleading guilty on
That's
our
right.
program. Well, this morning, a little economics lesson and some news from Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. To be
morning.
Successful, Louise, right, if you're a retailer, you have to be able to make your prices stick, right? Right?
Right.
And if consumers believe if they just wait that prices are going to drop, they don't buy. It's kind of a retail psych out.
Right.
And some luxury retailers, you say, like Saks Fifth Avenue, are trying to out-psych out skeptical consumers.
They are. I mean, if you remember, John, retailers blew it last year because you put in holiday orders in the summer before the holidays, and they failed to see the recession that was looming. They ordered way too much. And over the holidays, they discounted. You could buy a lot of stuff very cheaply. So they're trying to reverse that, but it's a bit like a contest to see who will blink first. So they're throwing down the gauntlet. You've got the chief executive of Saks who talked to one of my colleagues at the New York Times and talked about how they're not going to mark stuff down. It's all the exclusivity. They don't have very much of any of the inventory.
So they're saying they don't have much. They're using scarcity.
Right.
To combat my skepticism about if I just wait prices.
Well, they're telling us it's scarce. They're telling us that we're returning to exclusivity and that if you want that exclusive item, you better run in and get it. But I kind of wonder if people want exclusive things anymore, if they're going to pay $3,000 for some pricey jacket.
Well, let's ask. I mean, is scarcity going to work for you? Will you take something at a higher price if you think you're not going to be able to get it if you wait a week? Call us at 877-8-MINDTAKE or email us at mindtake@thetakeaway.org. What do you think? Do you think that works?
You know what I've been doing lately? I call it shopping in my closet. I go in, I find something I haven't worn for a long time, and suddenly it's new. And so I don't know that I'm going to go out and buy something just for it to be exclusive. I like my closet.
Very quickly, does this only work for luxury retailers, or is this the kind of thing that would work across the board?
It's more commonly a tactic of luxury retailers. But remember, stores like Saks
come
went mass recently.
Don't you guys remember the Cabbage Patch doll craze?
That's
works
true.
Especially
That's true.
For
well,
kids.
But not at $5,000 tax price tag still.
new toys in the attic.
New toys in the attic.
Louise Story, thanks so much.
And our last takeout comes from you. We were talking yesterday about news from a government panel that wants to change the recommended age when women should start breast cancer screening. They pushed that recommended age forward 10 years, and you should start at 50 rather than 40, they say. And we asked our listeners what they thought. Well, some of you think screening should start younger, not later.
I think it's ludicrous. I think everyone from the age 30 up needs a yearly mammogram and a pap smear if you're a woman and a physical if you're a man.
The next caller shared a personal story of the benefits of early screening.
I might say that I have no family history of breast cancer and began getting mammograms at age 40, and I was diagnosed with breast cancer at age 45. I wonder what would have happened if I'd waited until age 50. I'm going to be fine.
Not everybody.
You know, it's stories like that that make the whole debate over this incredibly difficult, because that's one data point. But still,
it is.
You can't argue with her.
You can't argue with her.
No.
But, you know, on the macro level, the story changes, and not everyone agrees with her. Megan from Brooklyn emailed us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org. She writes, I'm 36. I'm someone who's already had a false positive based on a lump I discovered through self-exam. Even though there's breast cancer in my family, I don't plan to have annual mammograms. They're not always the best tools, and the stress of another false positive isn't something I want to deal with again. In the meantime, I keep feeling for problems radiation-free. But Annie Thomas from Ann Arbor, Michigan, writes with a sad story. He says, my wife did not get a mammogram at 40 because at the time it wasn't recommended. 4 years later, she was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer and eventually died of the disease. I firmly believe that had she had a screening mammogram 4 years earlier, she would be alive today. Stories on and views on breast cancer screening coming from you, our listeners, and more of them.
You need Freakonomics to resolve this kind of a debate. All week long, we've been speaking with Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner, who says, what people say is different from what people do, and he'd rather watch their actions rather than what they say. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Is it walking the walk or talking the talk that matters?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, campaigning. Now, that's fun, campaigning for president, especially if you win. But what about governing as president, particularly in this century? We're going to ask David Plouffe about his new book, The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. That interview in just a few minutes. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. That's the sound of Hamid Karzai being sworn in for a second term as president of Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was in Kabul for the ceremony, which was closed to the media. It was a bit of a high security situation. Hillary Clinton says she expects Karzai to deliver on his promises to free up U.S. and international forces in the country.
We expect outcomes that deliver on security, the buildup of an Afghan national security force as well as a national police force.
Back at home, the Senate is digesting the new version of the health care bill this morning. The Democrats' plan includes a public option, and they say it would expand coverage to millions of Americans and reduce the deficit. The price tag on the plan is nearly $850 billion over 10 years. A federal judge has accused the Army Corps of Engineers of negligence. He says the Army's poor oversight of a shipping channel contributed to massive flooding in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. That decision could make the government vulnerable to future lawsuits. And we're getting word that two U.S. servicemen have been killed in an explosion in southern Afghanistan. A NATO spokesman says it was caused by a suicide bomber. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Well, you heard it right there in the news. I mean, a busy week in an unbelievably busy and historic year for President Barack Obama. Winding down a trip to Asia, returning just as the Senate relaunches its debate about health care reform. Hamid Karzai inaugurated for a second term in Afghanistan as the administration considers what to do in Afghanistan, a new strategy possibly unveiled by the end of this month. There's rising unemployment in the economy. How does Barack Obama characterize all of this? He spoke with CBS News' Chip Reed yesterday.
We'd like to land some of these big planes right now. Yeah, we've got a lot of traffic circling in the air, and the runway's a little congested.
And on that congested runway, the approval ratings for Barack Obama are slipping under 50% for the first time. Well, it's one of the reasons why we asked David Plouffe, who ran Obama's presidential campaign, to join us this morning. He certainly had the president's ear when he was a candidate. He has a new book out, The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. David Plouffe, it's great to finally meet the voice behind all those emails I've been getting over the last year and a half.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for not putting me in your spam filter.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, I'm a journalist. I got to look at all the facts there. So, David Plouffe, how does governing stack up to the historic campaign, which you really describe in, elegiac terms in your book, which is a terrific read about the campaign, but how's governing going?
Well, he's, doing exactly as he said he would during 2 years on the campaign. So he's trying to finally move us forward on things like health insurance reform, on energy, already doing, I think, some really important things on education in terms of, increasing charter schools and paper reform. And so, and I think he's doing a great job of building and strengthening our relationship around the world, which I think will pay dividends, big dividends over time. So, but this is hard, obviously. We're not running a campaign out in the country where 50% of the people say they're for health care or passes. We've got a Congress to deal with. A lot of the things on energy, which are going to lead to great jobs of the future, go through Congress. So, but I think he's making great progress under very, very tough circumstances. Obviously, the economy is in terrible shape. It's improving in some ways, but too many people can't find work.
And, well, 10.2%
unemployment.
10.2% unemployment. You could even hear his frustration as he talked about his hair getting gray and that's a butt of jokes around the White House. I mean, do you sense a frustration?
I think that, of course, it's what keeps him up at night. And I think that what the recovery package did both stabilized the economy, and I think it was one of the major reasons we grew last quarter, which is important because that's how we're going to create jobs. And it created or saved, when all is said and done, over 3 million jobs. But, these jobs are largely going to be created by the private sector. And so what you have to do is create the conditions for growth. So companies, both big and large, have confidence in hiring. And obviously we're seeing some return in profitability. We're seeing the economy grow, but we're not seeing enough people hire folks. And we're going to have to do everything we can to do that. But again, most of these jobs are going to be created by the private sector.
David, in your book, let me read something to you out of your book. You're talking about election night, and you say the reaction was close to a kind of primal joy at seeing wrongs righted, at having risen up to achieve something cynics said couldn't be done. For most of us under a certain age, any prior familiarity with this feeling came secondhand from history books. Now we owned it. And to a certain extent, it seems to me that an election like that is a little bit like the difference between the romantic wedding and the difficulties of the marriage itself. What happens to that dream, that feeling of primal joy, as you say, now that you're in a presidency, which is complicated by all those things you just talked about?
Well, sure. But I'll give you one example. I think that, and I remain confident that, and I think we got a big assist last night on the CBO scoring of the Senate bill, which, is clearly going to reduce the deficit in a major way over time and provide a lot of health care coverage for people. If and when we pass health care reform, when Barack Obama spent 2 years going around the country and was talking about hope and change, that's what he was talking about. He wasn't talking about some gauzy feeling of optimism. It was about doing hard things that have bedeviled the country for a long time. So when we pass health care reform, I can assure you we've had millions of people out there working on health care, going door knocking, making phone calls. There is going to be a primal joy because it's something we've told and experienced that hasn't happened for a lot of reasons. And this is the intractable problems that he said the American, system of government wasn't dealing with, and that's what he's doing.
Well, we're not there yet on health care reform. It's going to be a tough fight in the Senate. I'm wondering if, going off that quote that Celeste read to you about owning the historic moment of the election, does Barack Obama own the Afghan war right now, own the situation in Iraq, own the 10.2% unemployment rate? It's not about inheriting Bush problems anymore, is it?
Well, he said he does. Obviously, we did both from a budget deficit problem, the financial crisis. Obviously, he inherited an absolute mess economically. But as he said, he's the president now, and he's making decisions.
And you own it.
What's that?
You own it.
Yeah, and he's obviously, I think, on Iraq. He promised during the campaign to wind that down and get combat troops out. And I think that, you know, by the end of next year, that should be the case. And having to make a very, very important decision, obviously, about the next phase in Afghanistan. So, of course, when you're president, it's an old expression, but a true one. The buck stops here.
All right. So then the pressure on you to deliver a second term and for Barack Obama to win a second term couldn't be higher. It's almost as though the historic moment you describe in your book is tarnished if Barack Obama can't win a second term.
No. And he spoke to this in some interviews over in China, which is that what he's focused on is trying to solve these problems, do these tough things. We're not focused on the next election. And I think that's the right approach, because if what you're doing is focusing on what this means in Ohio or Florida, you're not going to do tough things. I mean, that's been the problem in Washington. You know, everyone's focused on the next news cycle, the next election, not the next generation. So, you know, there'll be plenty of time for the next campaign. This one just ended a year ago, and the Republican campaign is already beginning. So we'll watch that, and we'll engage at the appropriate time. But I have a lot of confidence that he's making, you know, tough decisions, both in the short term and long term, that people will respond favorably to. But
if you get offered a position in the administration, would we say we're moving closer to that moment of focusing on the campaign?
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm spending a couple years on the outside and trying to spend as much time with my family. And, you know, I and everyone who worked on the campaign will do anything we can to help. And what form that takes, I'll know better in a year or so.
A year or so. We'll be watching. David Plouffe, campaign manager to Barack Obama and author of The Audacity to Win, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's Historic Victory. Thanks to David Plouffe. Coming up, Facebook recently rolled out a policy of offering memorial pages to website users who have passed away. It's life after death on the internet. Are we immortal in the digital sphere? We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This might be a bah humbug coming up here. I don't know.
I'm going to watch you for that and squelch it. I'm Celeste Headlee. It is the holiday season. No bah humbugs. It's the holiday season is coming up soon. That means there's a brand new population at risk of H1N1.
Oh, you better watch out. Better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming.
That's a different Perry Como than I have.
We added the sounds of coughing to that, just to illustrate the fact that Santas around the country are asking for priority on H1N1 vaccine shots because of the exposure they get to thousands of children.
Santas are vectors
sitting on their laps. You know, when a kid's sitting on your lap, the kid's face is in close proximity to your own. Who better to ask about this than one of the Santas? Ernest Berger is the president and founder of Santa America. It's one of the largest volunteer Santa organizations in the country. Good morning, Ernest.
Good morning, Celeste.
You actually play Santa all year round, not just at Christmas time.
Our Santas visit 365 days a year. We focus on children with in hospice, hospice with or in grievance situation with pediatric illness or suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. We're 24/7, so this is not an early call for Santa. I'm enjoying this thoroughly.
But how many kids would you estimate that you come in close contact with on, say, a monthly basis?
I would say during the holiday season, I'm going to see well over 2,000 children here before the end of the year. A typical mall Santa may see 5 or 6 times that number. But again, we're specializing in children in hospital and hospice, so it's a little bit more personal.
You went to your congressman down in Alabama and asked for priority vaccinations for the Santas in your group. Is the reasoning behind that you don't want your Santas to get sick, or just that they'd be carriers and symptomatic?
I think it's both. When we started the season, I mean, H1N1 is no stranger to us. It's been around now for a while, and obviously a very serious pandemic. We started to change our procedure for visits, and the most obvious you'll see when you visit with Santa Claus, Celeste and John, I believe you are going to visit with Santa Claus, aren't
you? Oh, sure, sure.
Okay, good.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of an elf litmus test.
But, yeah.
When you visit, you'll see Santa no longer wears gloves. We're going to use hand sanitizer, and we're going to try to make that a fun part of the Santa visit to keep the H1N1.
Here, Johnny, wipe your hands with hand sanitizer.
Ernest, I'm a little confused,
right?
Though. I mean,
okay, go ahead.
Why can't you just get on the phone, say to the CDC, I'm Santa, I need H1N1, and they just give it to you?
You know, I think that would be wonderful if it happened, and obviously I think Congressman Bonner is doing exactly that at this point. What I asked him to do, basically, in a meeting last week, is to advance the process for us to get access to the vaccine. As you know, this would not be a problem if we didn't have challenges in the distribution of vaccine. We're finding, as an example, among our members and among Santas in general, that some number already have the vaccine.
Two arguments here, though. Ernest Berger, president and founder of Santa America. One is you're still a special interest group, but on the other side, these are older men, and they're at high risk for H1N1 because they carry extra weight, most of them. So maybe there's an argument that they need the vaccine. Thank you very much, Ernest Berger, president and founder.
We must help Santa.
Well, absolutely.
That's important.
You have
time
five,
is running out.
You have nearly five kids who are expecting you to help.
Yes, vaccinate Santa.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, what happens to all those things that you stored on the internet, your blogs, your photos, your videos, your content on MySpace or Facebook? What happens when you pass away? We're going to talk about life after death on the internet in just a few minutes. First, though, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. A developing story right now, the Federal Aviation Administration has confirmed that a computer glitch is causing some flights to be delayed around the country. It's unclear exactly how many flights are currently affected. The FAA says the computer system in Georgia that pilots use to file their flight plans is at fault. We're going to bring you more on that story as we get more details. Also, in the past few minutes, some new figures on jobs. New jobless claims remained unchanged last week at 505,000.
And that's good news. Federal judge in New Orleans has ruled that poor oversight by the Army Corps of Engineers contributed to the flooding in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. Pierce O'Donnell is the attorney for a group of plaintiffs.
I think the decision is founded on 200 years of arrogance by the Army Corps of Engineers, which has never been held accountable in a courtroom in America for a major catastrophic disaster like it caused here.
Seven plaintiffs share more than $700,000. President Obama has wrapped up his tour of Asia, heading back to Washington now. Before he left South Korea, he had some stern words for the North Koreans regarding nuclear issues. We spoke with John Sudworth, the correspondent for our partner, the BBC, in Seoul, South Korea, earlier this morning. And the last time we focused on this, according to John, there was some impetus to actually opening direct talks between the U.S. and North Korea. We asked John where that stands now that Barack Obama left Seoul this morning.
Well, on that specific point, there was at least a glimmer of hope raised today. President Obama, in his press conference following his talks with the South Korean president, announced that the U.S. ambassador, the special ambassador to the North Korean talks, Stephen Bosworth, will visit Pyongyang on the 8th of December. That was something that has long been anticipated but had remained unconfirmed until now. He will go there with the main intention of trying to persuade North Korea to return to the negotiations concerning its nuclear ambitions. And that was the main focus of the talks between the two presidents as they sat down today. How do you convince North Korea to come in from the cold and give up its atomic ambition?
So, John Sudworth, how do South Koreans view this? Do they think it's a good idea to engage in direct talks, or do they view it as a needless concession on the part of the Obama administration?
No, I think there's wide support here for the principle, at least, of engaging and negotiating with North Korea. There is, of course, a wide range of views about how much should be given away in that process, how much should be based on careful step-by-step assurances and verifiable steps from North Koreans. There are other people who believe that engagement should happen unilaterally and without conditions. But as far as the principle itself goes, I think South Koreans will be very cheered to see the Americans attempting once again to convince North Korea to return to the nuclear talks. The real question is, and in fact we heard it raised by both Mr. Obama and Mr. Lee, the South Korean president today, the real question being asked now is whether North Korea has ever really seriously intended to give up its trump card, its nuclear weapons, I think a certain sign of frustration and a little bit of skepticism creeping in to American foreign policy. They'll send Ambassador Bosworth to Pyongyang next month, but I don't think anybody's expecting any sign of an immediate breakthrough.
That update came from John Sudworth, correspondent with our partner, the BBC. We spoke with him earlier this morning.
In the wake of the shootings at Virginia Tech, Facebook officials say they realized they needed a new policy for its users who had passed away, and they've started offering memorial pages for website users who've died, allowing users to have a digital presence even after their death. And it made us wonder, what happens to all those emails, the files, the pictures, the videos that you've uploaded when you're no longer there to pay the user fees or access the account? And what if nobody knows your passwords? To answer that, we have Corvita Raven, tech blogger for the website SheGeeks, and also Jeremy Toman. Jeremy founded a firm called Legacy Locker, which is like a digital estate planner that informs your loved ones of your passwords to all of your online accounts, including your financial accounts, after you pass away. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
Good morning.
Jeremy, the idea for your company, as I understand it, came from a situation with your 94-year-old grandmother. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, she was fairly a tech-savvy lady. She and I emailed. She actually emailed with the entire family and actually friends literally around the world. She played bridge on Yahoo. She knew what Googling was. So she was pretty good up there. And what happened was she passed away, and my father and I tried to get into her Hotmail account. And it was at the same time as the funeral. So, you know, we put in a little bit of an effort, but we quickly realized we weren't getting anywhere. And there was just no way in, and there just seemed to be no one to contact.
You had no rights to access her accounts.
Yeah, we didn't know their password. There was and nobody else did either. And unfortunately, that was that.
Okay, so Corvita Raven, have you actually spoken with family members about passwords? Have you shared your passwords with your family members already?
Oh, yes. It's something that me and my mom go back and forth on all the time. I know about hers, and she knows about mine. And I also have, you know, I've shown her ways that she can use web browsers to kind of pull up the passwords. Some web browsers allow you to save them automatically. So for when I do, for certain sites that I do save them to, I make sure she's aware of it and she knows how to access it in case there were anything to happen.
Corvita, you know, Jeremy's business is Legacy Locker. It helps you deal with the issue of access. You know, that gives your family members or friends or relatives passwords so they can get into the accounts. But I wanted to ask you, what about ownership? If you've got videos or photos stored on say, Snapfish or somewhere else, if you have content stored on, say, a public blog space, who owns that content after you pass away?
Well, you would have to go into user terms to see what the case is. It varies from site to site. MySpace deceased policy, it's kind of vague, but they won't grant grant access to your next of kin or delete any of the content or settings on your account. You'd have to do that yourself, but they can request that the information be removed if they feel it's, you know, if the family feel that that's something that needs to be removed from the page and whatnot. But for the most part, you're kind of on your own with these sites. They're, Facebook will not remove your page either. They'll memorialize your page, which will remove any kind of sensitive information from it and allow whoever's still a friend of your page to still see it. But at the same time, no one in the future will be able to add friends to that page. It kind of takes away the right for the family to have any type of control over it. So after you die, it passes on to Facebook. You know, it passes on to MySpace. Your content doesn't belong to you, and it doesn't belong to your family either.
Jeremy, do you give users of Legacy Locker any kind of guidance on that? If Facebook or MySpace owns some or all of that content, how can they use it? Do you help people deal with that issue?
Well, the purpose of the site, it's really a lot like a will. So we're passing the information along and letting the user basically establish what they want to do with that account and pass that along to a next kin or a relative or friend or whatever that might be. because along with the issue, as Corvita was pointing out, of ownership, there's also an issue of desire. For my family, for example, my wife doesn't really want to see a Jeremy Toman on Facebook if something happens to me. She just doesn't want to see me in a buddies list or any of those kind of things ever. So, and to others, by the way, it's a totally different story. Some people want to be memorialized online. And part of the point and value of Legacy Locker and services like ours is to give people the choice to control what would happen in that kind of scenario.
So it sounds like the takeaway here is that people need to take their online presence seriously as they take the writing of their will. That was Corvita Raven, tech blogger for the website SheGeeks, and Jeremy Toman, founder and CEO of Legacy Locker. Thanks to both of you.
So all week long, we've been speaking to Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner. And basically, the super Freakonomics lens on reality is boils down to this. What people say is often radically different than what they do, and measuring what they do is a better key to the reality of a situation, and that affects policy and all kinds of stories that we do on the program, including,
absolutely,
Hamid Karzai talks a good game about corruption, but what does he actually do about it? We want to get your take on this story, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And Nancy in Brooklyn writes that Mr. Dubner is so very 100% unequivocally absolutely correct, especially when it comes to the male species, that I can't believe you'll get a debate out of this one.
You might get a debate on the male characterization.
Give this your take, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
But not from me, Nancy. I'm not going to debate that. Here's your takeaway.
It would really be cutting off our nose to spite our face if we pulled out all civilian aid because we couldn't tolerate corruption in that country.
That's Isabel Coleman, senior fellow of U.S. foreign policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She spoke to us earlier about the future of Afghanistan in light of Hamid Karzai's re-inauguration this morning. I am Celeste Headley.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. It could be the season finale, healthcare reform in the U.S. Senate.
Clear.
The wait is over.
Do you have a problem with me?
We all acknowledge this legislation is a tremendous step forward.
So why don't you just settle this?
Hey, wait! Saves lives, saves money, and protects Medicare, makes Medicare stronger.
As the season ends, anything can happen.
The next episode of Healthcare Reform is going to take place on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Will Harry Reid get his 60 votes, or will a Republican filibuster make this a 60-hour special episode? ER returns to C-SPAN.
Clear.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, November 19th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley.
Good morning, John. You know that health care plan that you're talking about in the Senate has an $849 billion price tag, but that's actually, as Harry Reid says, a cost savings.
We're also
going to get a new installment of the multimedia series, The Value, with Farah Chidea, looking at how our priorities change in the face of economic hard times. And we're going to continue our Super Freakonomics week. We're going to look at seatbelts versus car seats. Are seatbelts safer?
But first, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick joins us. Todd, after a stretch of some late nights there, Harry Reid has a health care reform bill. But are there still some all-nighters ahead for Reid and the Democrats going forward?
I think there might be nothing but all-nighters for Harry Reid and the Democrats coming up. There's going to be a couple of all-nighters between tonight and Saturday when they're going to have the first test vote, because not even all of the Democrats have committed to that 60 votes you just mentioned. There are going to be a lot of late nights during weeks and weeks of amendments on the floor. This bill is going to change significantly. There's going to be late nights to get it off the floor, not to mention late nights with the House. This bill is a lot different from what Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats passed out of the House, so they're going to debate this even before they start talking to the president about it.
Well, the first test vote comes on Saturday. Todd Zwillick, stay with us. We actually want to get to the drama yesterday with Eric Holder in the Judiciary Committee. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
More details out now about flight days delays around the country. The FAA says it's experiencing problems with a computer system that collects airlines' flight plans. FAA spokeswoman Kathleen Bergen says she does not know how many flights are affected or when the problem will be resolved. A spokesman for AirTran Airways says there's no danger to flights in the air, and flights are still taking taking off and landing, but he said flight plans are having to be entered manually because of the computer problem that could cause delays. Atlanta International Airport is understood to be particularly badly affected. In other words, as we've been said, the lines in the sand are being drawn in the Senate. The Democrats unveiled their health care bill last night, and here's Majority Leader Harry Reid.
We all acknowledge this legislation is a tremendous step forward because it saves lives, saves money, and protects Medicare, makes Medicare stronger.
Heading overseas, Hamid Karzai has been sworn in for a second term as president of Afghanistan. Karzai promised to prosecute corrupt officials and end a culture of graft. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Kabul for the ceremony says this is long overdue.
Results of this election have to be seen and felt in the lives of the people of Afghanistan.
The inauguration comes in the same day that two American servicemen were killed by a suicide bomber in southern Afghanistan.
And that inauguration took place as the city of Kabul was entirely shut down. Very high security there in Afghanistan. President Obama now on his way home from his Asia trip. Before he left, he explained to the Today Show why he's been taking his time deciding on a strategy for Afghanistan.
This decision will put us on a path towards ending the war.
Decision is expected perhaps as soon as the end of the month. New job figures are out. New jobless claims remained unchanged last week at 505,000. That's about what analysts expected. So the Dow will just open at 10,400 in less than a half an hour. The S&P is hovering around 1,100, and the NASDAQ is just below 2,200. All futures trading suggests it will be a negative opening when Wall Street gets underway a little less than a half hour from now. Freakonomics author Stephen Dubner is with us. What people say is a more accurate reading of reality, or is a less accurate reading of reality
right.
than what they do. Measure what they do. Forget about what they say. Is that true in your life? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Tell us your experience and how well do you walk the walk or talk the talk?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Well, they were talking the talk last night. Senate Democrats were right.
They
got a lot of walking to do to get health care reform passed. I mean, Senate Democrats were all historic and weepy positively last evening when they rolled out the $849 billion and 2,074-page health care reform bill. It's less than $1 billion a page by my math.
Good math.
But, you know, we should get that fact checked. But probably over the next few weeks, every one of those pages could be rewritten as this bill faces a tough fight in the Senate, and it's got to be resolved with the House of Representatives. So maybe it's the case that the main event yesterday on Capitol Hill was taking place over in the Senate Judiciary Committee.
If we captured bin Laden tomorrow, would he be entitled to Miranda warnings at the moment of capture?
Again, I'm not. That all depends. I mean,
well, it does not depend. If you're going to prosecute anybody in civilian court, our law is clear that the moment custodial interrogation occurs, the defendant, the criminal defendant, is entitled to a lawyer and to be informed of their right to remain silent.
Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee wanted answers from Attorney General Eric Holder, who faced senators the first time since the Obama administration announced that a civilian trial would be the place for resolving the issue of the purported 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. There will also be military tribunals for other detainees at Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, which the Obama administration has promised to close as early as next year. Joining us, Todd Zwillick, once again, Washington correspondent, and also Professor Matthew Waxman, who's an Associate Professor of National Security Law at Columbia Law School. Good morning to both of you.
Hi, good morning, John.
Good morning.
So, Todd, first of all, what was it like in that hearing room? I mean, this was a very different scene than Alberto Gonzalez being questioned about politics by Republicans and Democrats.
Well, it was, and the tables were turned. You know, Democrats, as you could predict, were very supportive for the most part of Attorney General Eric Holder's decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four others, by the way, in the Southern District of New York. Republicans are livid about it, I think, philosophically and ideologically, but they also see an important political element here, which is a lot of the public sort of reflexively reacts to the idea of treating someone like the 9/11 mastermind as a civilian criminal defendant as opposed to a a war criminal or an enemy on the battlefield as kind of repugnant. Republicans know that. So they're also playing to the cameras, but there were some pretty interesting legal concerns raised that Holder had to deal with as well.
Professor Matthew Waxman, is what Holder is doing something that's been dictated by the Supreme Court or the rule of law, or is he making a judgment call here? And what do you make of the Republicans' suspicion that using a civilian court is a sign of a weakness in some way, leaves us vulnerable?
Well, I think it probably is a judgment call, among a range of options that the government has. Since 9/11, there's been this fundamental debate about whether we should approach counterterrorism as a matter of law enforcement for our criminal courts, or as a matter of war, in which case the president can capture and detain enemy combatants and perhaps in some cases prosecute them for war crimes in military tribunals. What we see the Obama administration doing now is on a case-by-case basis sort of straddling that debate, really saying that in some cases we will prosecute in federal court, but we will also keep open the option of prosecuting some Guantanamo detainees or others in military commissions, and still others we may continue to hold pursuant to war powers without any trial at all.
You make a good point. All the options are still on the table. But what do you make of that exchange with Lindsey Graham saying that Osama bin Laden would be read his Miranda rights?
Well, you know, I think what we heard was Attorney General Holder not wanting to be pinned down on that precisely because the government is really trying to keep its options open, especially in some extreme cases like Osama bin Laden. I think the government wants to keep all options on the table, not necessarily commit itself to going the federal court criminal justice route as it's going with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in part because it doesn't want to limit its own flexibility.
But isn't there also a question of the fact that Erica Holder is actually correct, that all of these legal issues do depend on the situation? They depend on where bin Laden is actually apprehended, if he's apprehended. They depend on a lot of things that play into the legal system that are complicated.
I think that's right. I mean, we have a very rich set of traditions of our criminal law. Some basic building blocks that go back centuries, but many of the details about exactly what rights attach at what time, et cetera, are hard to determine in this new context of facing a transnational terrorist organization spanning continents, and so you're absolutely right. Depending on the precise circumstances, where is he captured, what is the role of U.S. personnel or foreign personnel, into what kinds of justice track might he be moved, all of those factors are going to impact the set of rights to which he'd be entitled.
Well, Professor Waxman and Todd Zwillick, it was remarkable listening to the hearing yesterday how much is up in the air, even though Eric Holder tried to say, no, in fact, things are locked down. Here he is talking about his decision to have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried in a civilian court.
He will not select the prosecution venue. I will select it, and I have.
Now, Holder says he selected the venue, but we don't know actually how Khalid Sheikh Mohammed will plea, right, Todd?
No, we don't. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had initially wanted to plead guilty and be executed in a military tribunal several years ago. When it became clear that his plea might make it impossible to execute him, it was rescinded. We have no idea what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would do,
right,
in a civil setting. There's just no way to know. And one of the key questions here, Republicans were saying, why a civilian court? Eric Holder keeps saying, there's things I know about this case that I can't share, either because they're classified or because I don't want to prejudice the case.
Which is why I'm dying to see a civilian trial here, just me personally as a journalist. Professor Matthew Waxman, very quickly before we go, what do you make of this plea issue? Can he plea any way he wants at this point?
Probably, and there's some question about how he's going to plea. I mean, we've seen in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he's somebody who likes actually to brag and boast about his terrorist exploits, but we don't know exactly how this one's going to play out. I mean, one of the virtues of our system of justice is that it's very open and transparent, and that's what, on the other hand, gives him perhaps a platform for propaganda.
Well, a virtue to some, not so much for the Republican senators who were yesterday in that hearing with Eric Holder talking about the decision to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in a civilian court. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, thanks as always. And our thanks to Professor Matthew Waxman, Associate Professor of National Security Law at Columbia Law School. Thanks so much. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some headlines.
As we've been reporting, there's been some flight cancellations and delays nationwide today because of a problem with the FAA computer system that stores airline flight plans. FAA spokeswoman Kathleen Bergen says she doesn't know exactly how many flights are affected or when the problem will be resolved. She says, quote, "We are processing flight plans manually and expect some delays." Some new figures on jobs. New jobless claims remained unchanged last week at 505,000. The Associated Press says that about matches analysts' expectations. And meanwhile, AOL says it plans to cut about a third of its workforce now that it's spun off from Time Warner since last December. About 2,300 people are expected to lose their jobs.
As we mentioned, the Democrats have rolled out their Senate health care bill in the Senate. It faces a long, long road before passage. First test vote on that health care reform bill could come on Saturday. President Obama has concluded his four-nation tour of Asia. Before he left South Korea, the president confirmed he will send an envoy to North Korea in December, and he had a message for the North Koreans to begin serious talks on nuclear issues. NATO says two U.S. service members have been killed in an explosion in southern Afghanistan. They occur on the day Hamid Karzai was re-inaugurated for a second term. Coming up, the next installment in our value series with Farai Chidea.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first takeout comes from Washington, and we don't often focus on votes in House committees as big economic stories, but some critics have said that the banking industry actually helped to deregulate, to write the legislation that deregulated the industry back in the 80s and 90s. But a vote yesterday in the House Financial Services Committee suggests that the cloud of the banking industry may be at an end. Louise Story from our partner in the New York Times joins us.
Morning.
What happened yesterday, Louise?
You know, I got to tell you, I was pretty surprised. The House Financial Services Committee, 38-29, passed this amendment that would allow a council of regulators to take apart companies that are too big, that are healthy. So everyone's been talking about giving the government some sort of power to take apart companies that get in trouble. But what this says is, if we think you're too big and we think that you could get in trouble later on, years down the road, we'll take you apart now. And the reason this surprised me is it's really an affront to everything we've seen happen in the last 2 years. Because if you think about what regulators did, they encouraged companies to get bigger. They encouraged J.P. Morgan to buy Bear Stearns and to buy Washington Mutual. And they encouraged Wells Fargo to buy Wachovia. And they encouraged Bank of America to buy Merrill. So they have been creating these bigger companies. And if this passes, it's a major backtracking.
So it's a complete reversal.
Yes.
And it also represents a huge sort of escalation of the power of the federal government to basically come into a successful business venture and
yes.
say, sorry, we're gonna reduce
yes,
you down
they
here.
Said that they might not approve mergers because of it. They might force sales of units of companies. It would be a major change in the way government works. It still has to pass in the House and the Senate, so it has a long road.
And there could be constitutional questions here, depending if it,
yes,
if it is actually
there could
passed.
Be.
How much was on the line for the bank lobby on this? How much did they try
huge.
To get this happen?
And that's another reason I was so surprised, because people in the banking community were laughing about this when it first came up a couple weeks ago. And I was talking to someone at a large industry group last week, and they said, well, we're writing letters, but, you know, it's not likely to pass. You had groups like the Partnership for New York City, which is co-chaired by Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs,
right.
writing letters about this. And they usually have a lot of clout, but this really says to me they're losing clout in Washington.
Again, it's just a committee vote, but a very interesting bellwether of what's going on in Washington. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
Thank you.
Our next takeout is an installment in our multimedia series called The Value. It's hosted by our friend and correspondent, Farai Chidea. The Value focuses on how people's priorities change during economic hard times. And for the latest installment, Farai spoke with a theater actor, Tanya Selvaratnam. Tanya doesn't make a lot of money. She earns about $50,000 a year in her job. She works as an actor and as a producer. But instead of taking another part-time job, maybe to add to her earnings, she took on something that doesn't make her any money. In fact, it costs her money. She started a book drive for Sri Lankan children. And when Farai caught up with Tanya last week, Tanya was swimming in a mountain of books surrounding her in her small Manhattan apartment.
Well, this is just the beginning, actually. I'm getting a little bit nervous about how many more might come.
Tell me how this came about, this project of trying to get books and who they're for.
Well, for the last few months, I've been trying to figure out how I can help back home. I was born in Sri Lanka. I am very much American as well. And it's been frustrating for me to be over here and to see how much suffering has been going on. You know, I'm not a humanitarian, I'm not an expert, I'm not somebody who's going to go out in the field, but I thought, what can I send? And so I asked around and I did some research, and books seem to be in need, because there are a lot of orphans, there are a lot of displaced children who are not in their homes.
It took Tanya about 4 months to figure out just how to go about shipping the books overseas to Sri Lanka. And 2 weeks ago, she put out a call to people she knows to donate the books. Tanya doesn't really live a luxurious lifestyle. She does not have a lot of resources to spare, but she says she was compelled to do something for her homeland.
I'm very much, first and foremost, a full-time artist and producer. I would never pretend to be a humanitarian or a do-gooder, but I think I have certain skills as an organizer, so that's what I try to put to use. Because I think that, you know, when we have so much privilege and so much freedom, we have to do something. I mean, I think if there's any reason to continue the human race, it's like to continue bringing in people who will do something good. These kids have been through so much trauma, and so many of them are alone, that books are company.
Farai Chidea was speaking to Tanya Selvaratnam, who's putting her efforts into a book drive for Sri Lankan children. That's from our ongoing series called The Value with Farai Chidea. You can hear more of that interview, and you can also watch a video of Tanya and Farai at thetakeaway.org.
Last takeout comes from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, our sports contributor. And the NBA is about 10 or so games in. Where do we stand at this point? East versus West? Old players versus young bucks?
Well, right now, the Lakers, obviously, they're 8-3. They're the team to watch because they're the world champions. But I would also point your attention to the Phoenix Suns. They're playing great basketball right now. They're typically a team that starts off fast and finishes slow. So
right, that's
something to keep in mind.
Heartbreakers, we call them.
Indeed, heartbreakers. So there's also the Portland Trailblazers. They're the youngest team that's really exciting. And that's a team that if you want
to
watch good, great basketball to watch.
How about the East? The Knicks, of course, and the Nets are, forget about
Well, the
about
Nets
them.
Are still 0-12. Now they're 0-12. The Knicks won last night, but they might pick up this guy Allen Iverson, who some of you may know is a former MVP of the National Basketball Association, and he was let go by the Memphis Grizzlies, and so they might pick him up in that little sort of we need anybody that can help sweepstakes.
And again, a lot of people say that the season, the NBA season, really starts in the playoffs. So it's such early going in the NBA. Major League Baseball handed out its Manager of the Year awards. Anything significant there?
Yeah, I think Jim Tracy, who took over for the Rockies after in the midseason, led them on a tear through the end of the season. They were riding this crest of this wave into the playoffs,
right.
And they played amazing baseball up until they ran into the Philadelphia Phillies. But Jim Tracy definitely deserves that. Mike Socha won it in the AL because he rallied the team around the death of Nick Gaidhart.
And Girardi came in third of the Yankees, but great stuff. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, thanks so much. Coming up, a look at Hamid Karzai, his second term, not as good karma as his first.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
coming up, Hamid Karzai was inaugurated for his second term as the president of Afghanistan today. That's after a messy election that was filled with allegations of corruption. But when Hamid Karzai first took office, it was a very different scene than what we had today. We're going to talk about that change in just a few minutes. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. As we've been reporting, there are some flight cancellations and delays nationwide this morning because of a problem with the FAA computer system that stores online flight plans. FAA spokeswoman Diane Spitaleri says she doesn't know how exactly many flights are affected or when the problem will be resolved.
We're having to do things that we would normally do in an automated fashion manually, so it's going to slow down the system considerably.
The FAA says it has full radar coverage and communications with planes, but it's asking passengers to check the status of their flights online before heading to the airport.
Healthcare reform bill was unveiled in the Senate yesterday. President Obama has wrapped up his Asian tour, and there's a sell-off on Wall Street this morning, as predicted. The 2009 word of the year, folks, is admonish. Merriam-Webster chose the word because it was in the news a lot this year, with Congress admonishing South Carolina Congressman Joe Wilson for shouting, "You lie," at the president. Emaciated and Nugatory were the runners-up for other reasons. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Five years ago, Hamid Karzai was sworn in as Afghanistan's 12th president.
The significance of this day in Afghan history will really depend on what happens in the future. If we deliver to the Afghan people what we promised, this will be a great day. If we don't deliver, this will go into oblivion.
High hopes for Karzai. He's college-educated, a former exile, outspoken enemy of both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. He fought with the Mujahideen. His father was reportedly gunned down by the Taliban, and when he began his administration by removing many of the warlords from his cabinet, experts thought he would pursue aggressive reform. Excitement in Afghanistan 5 years ago, no longer today. On his second inauguration, Hamid Karzai signified the beginning of his second five-year term in office. Here's a taste of the talk from the streets of Kabul.
A country with a corruption is nothing. But if there's no corruption, I mean, that government will be the people government, people will like it, and people will support it. And the government without corruption, it will be a good security, everything will be going well.
The Afghan people thought they were getting a government without corruption 5 years ago. What happened to the reform agenda of Hamid Karzai? To answer that, we're joined by Robert Finn, U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan from 2002 to 2003. He's currently a scholar at the Liechtenstein Institute of the Woodrow Wilson School in Princeton. Also, Dr. Nadir Attash, a former official in the government of Afghanistan. He lived there most recently from 2002 to 2006, and he's also the author of the book Turbulence, The Tumultuous Journey of One Man's Quest for Change in Afghanistan. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
So let me go to you first, Robert Finn. When Hamid Karzai first came into office, there was a lot of talk about how he would bring reform to the country and turn around a history of corruption in the Afghanistan government. What happened to the man who was inaugurated 5 years ago?
Well, I always thought that his problem, I was there, of course, in 2002, 2003, before that inauguration, and I thought his problems would begin when he had to become the executive president of the country, and I was hoping that he would mature and grow into the office, and I don't think he has.
So, Dr. Nadir Attash, what about the office does not fit Hamid Karzai? What is he lacking, if he is, to make him an effective president?
I think he lacks the will and the wisdom to carry the office, although he had enough time to grow into the office, but his cozy relationship with the warlords, with unsavory characters, his lax attitude about rule of law and also corruption, I think those are the things, plus his management skills, are things that are haunting us now.
Well, and Celeste rightly points out, I mean, what a fall from grace. I mean, the excitement surrounding Hamid Karzai, right after September 11th was extraordinary, and we're certainly far from that today. I wonder if we could turn it around, though. I mean, if you go back to Babrak Kamal, the leader under the Soviet invasion, Najibullah, the Taliban, the various warlords who ruled in Afghanistan. I mean, you could make the argument, Ambassador Finn, that Afghanistan is simply ungovernable, period.
Well, and lots of people, too, make that argument. the tools were not there for Karzai to govern properly, and most importantly, in my view, and I've been saying this since I was there, is that they have not set up a proper government bureaucracy. They haven't trained government officials. They haven't set up proper salary scales, the kind of things that we did in this country at the end of the 19th century that turned our government from a fairly corrupt system into what we have today, a very uncorrupt governmental system.
Dr. Attash, you know, in the United States, we had a very optimistic view of Karzai, almost a sort of legendary hero's view of Karzai. And I'm wondering, 5 years ago when he was first inaugurated, was that view of him shared by the people of Afghanistan?
Yes, the view was shared by the people of Afghanistan, including myself and a lot of my friends, especially the Afghan-Americans who left their jobs and went to help rebuild the country. However, I think the programs did not started as an ambassador is right, that we did not help Karzai so that he could manage and run the country. I think we needed to, you know, the U.S. needed to sever its ties with the unsavory characters, the warlords. It needed to think about the reconstruction assistance in a very effective way. And most of our dollars are being wasted through the programs that we administer in Afghanistan. So the blame is not totally Karzai, I think. We need to share the blame.
Robert Finn, another thing that which strikes me as a contrast is that it's only been a few years since Hamid Karzai was proudly announcing to the international community that they have a lot of development going on in Afghanistan, so that for the first time in years, the economy there was growing. And that's clearly not the case now. So what happened to the development in Afghanistan? Was it the corruption of the government that halted that development, or did the halt in development lead to what's happened with the government?
No, he was correct. There has been a lot of development that has gone on. The per capita income has trebled. There are lots of indices that are good. The problem is that they're not sufficient and that we haven't received the proper return on the money that has been spent in Afghanistan. I agree with Dr. Attash. His analysis was quite correct. We should have weaned ourselves away from the warlords, and we should have looked at our reconstruction program. We have layers of bidding built into that program that mean that the greater part of the money doesn't get to Afghanistan. All of those things should have been corrected along the way, and they were not.
One quick last question for both of you, and let me start with Dr. Nadir Attash for your answer on this. First of all, can Hamid Karzai turn it around? Can he become the kind of president that he needs to be for Afghanistan? And if so, what's the first thing that he has to do?
I think he can. I strongly believe that Afghanistan is still a winnable situation, but we need to help him, and he needs to help himself also. And also that we need to bring the people of Afghanistan into the picture as well. Hamid Karzai needs to put a very strong and competent team as a first step. And I was watching the inauguration to the wee hours in the night, last night, and he mentioned that. And in fact, when he mentioned that his cabinet and team will be competent, there was applause from the audience, and that was the only time the applause, although he said, let's stop the applause and then do the applause at the end. But the people were so enthusiastic when they heard that the competent government is under formation.
Thank you. That's Dr. Nadir Attash, former Afghan government official and author of Turbulence. Also, Ambassador Robert Finn joined us, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan from 2002 to 2003. Coming up, we're going to talk more about super freakonomics with the author Stephen Dubner. Today, he says car seats for children are not as safe as we think they are. That's in a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Long way to go, but Senate Democrats unveiled last night their health care reform bill. Full Senate's going to consider it. 2,074 pages, $849 billion over 10 years. We thought it'd be a good moment to check in on the compromises, the non-starters, and the principles at work in this bill. Joining us again, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Also, Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton. Professor Starr, good morning.
Good to be with you.
So I want this conversation to go as efficiently as possible, because there's a lot of sort of consumer-related principles that I think people would love to know where they stand in this bill. And, of course, we do have to talk politics. But first of all, Barack Obama campaigned on a mandate to make insurance mandatory for all consumers, thereby reducing the number of uninsured in America. Where's the mandate, Todd Zwillick, in this bill? How does it stand?
Well, the mandate, well, Democrats call this shared responsibility, John. It's not called a mandate. Mandate's a bad word. Okay, the rest of us call it a mandate. The mandate is really on individuals, you and me. Basically, everybody has to get insurance. Now, if you have a lower income, if you're poor, they're expanding Medicaid. More people will have access to the Medicaid health insurance program for the poor. Middle income people will have to get insurance, but the idea here is to try to create lower cost insurance options, require everybody to have insurance, but then all of us, the taxpayers, are paying for cost sharing and for subsidies, really tax credits and cash for people, so that they can buy insurance. This bill does not have, like, the House, let me put it this way, the House had a mandate on employers. Many of them must provide insurance. This bill doesn't really have a mandate. It doesn't say employers must provide coverage. However, it does say that employers that can afford to provide coverage but don't will have to pay part of the cost into the government. It's really to prevent sort of free riders. It's to prevent employers who can afford it from sort of riding off the system and not providing coverage.
All right, so let's talk politics then. The Chris Dodd says there's a public option in there, but some Republicans aren't so happy with this bill. Here's Senator Orrin Hatch.
We don't want just something through the Senate. It ought to be a bill of some magnitude and decency, rather than just a partisan hack bill, which is what it's been so far.
Are those code words, partisan hack bill or magnitude and decency, Todd Zwillick?
Yeah, those are code words for this debate is going to go a lot slower than Chris Dodd and Harry Reid want it to, and that's the nature of the Senate. Republicans have every incentive politically and in a policy vein to slow this down. John, the public option is in there. Democrats are all excited about it, but the bottom line is it's not staying in there.
It's not staying.
It's not staying. Not the public option that's in there now. Right now they have the national public option where states can opt out if they pass a law saying we want to opt out. There right now are not 60 votes for that proposal to stay in. And Harry Reid, over the next several weeks, is going to need 60 votes to keep it in. And Democratic leadership is acknowledging that they basically don't have it. That's going to change on the floor.
Paul Starr, give me a sense. Should American consumers and voters be excited about this plan, whatever form it ends up in?
Yes, I think they should be. I think millions of people who don't have insurance should be excited, but many others who do have insurance, whose insurance really turns out to be lousy when they get sick, they should be excited because there's going to be much better protection of the standards of insurance. And I think that is going to be crucial for many people who don't realize they have an interest in this.
And of course, there are many people totally opposed to this health care reform. Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton. And of course, our thanks to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Next episode of Health Care Reform in the Senate.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, Freakonomics takes a look at kid car seats. Are they as safe? They make us feel good, but is it warranted in the statistics? Actually, Stephen Dubner came up with his own statistics to prove the conventional wisdom wrong. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. And as we've been reporting, flight cancellations and delays around the nation this morning because of a problem with the FAA computer system that stores airline flight plans. Here's FAA spokeswoman Kathleen Bergen giving advice to travelers on Atlanta's WSB television network.
Anyone who's planning to fly today should log on to www.fly.faa.gov to get an assessment of the system in a real time.
Although if you're in a plane right now, it's not going to help you. The FAA says it does have full radar coverage and communication with all planes.
A federal judge in New Orleans has ruled that poor oversight by the Army Corps of Engineers contributed to flooding in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was one of those attending today's inauguration of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. She said the U.S. expects a strong stand against corruption, and President Karzai has pledged that Afghan security forces will take over primary responsibility from the U.S. and other foreign troops within 5 years. Nick Childs is the defense correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
Training the Afghan forces to take over the responsibility for security in their own country is absolutely at the heart of the Western strategy there. Mr. Karzai's declared ambition now is to do so in 5 years. The US President Barack Obama says he's close to making a decision on the request from the US and NATO commander General Stanley McChrystal for an extra 40,000 troops for the NATO-led mission, many of whom will be to help the training effort. But even if the president gives him everything he wants, there are question marks over whether that goal's achievable. Western commanders insist there's been considerable progress, but the image of the Afghan security forces, especially the police, remains of a poorly led, largely illiterate and often corrupt organisation. There's been much focus on Western plans. The Western dignitaries at President Karzai's inauguration will no doubt be reminding him that he too has a responsibility to recruit and commit the resources and efforts needed to produce an effective Afghan military and police force.
That's the BBC's defense correspondent Nick Childs, and that's some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
I'll meet your Freakonomics and raise you Super Freakonomics all week long. Stephen Dubner, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog, and the new book, Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance, has been taking a look with us at the world through the Freakonomics lens. Tomorrow we're going to talk football and what it's like in Stephen Dubner's own home, Freakonomics-wise. But today we are applying the Freakonomics lens to the most benign and friendly little objects in our lives, kid car seats, right? Why do you want to take on kid car seats?
Well, let me start with the good news. Yeah. Okay? The good news is that life...
Everyone has them, right?
Well, everyone has them, yeah.
They're actually legal. You're supposed to have them.
Yeah, you have to have
them. By law.
Overall, the good news is that life expectancy increased dramatically in the last century. And a big reason is that children are much less likely to die from various causes. So that's obviously great news. The other good news is that the rate of auto fatalities over the past 60 years in the U.S. has also fallen dramatically, mostly because of seatbelts. The bad news is that traffic fatalities are still the leading cause of death for U.S. Children. Okay, so of course we want to do everything we can to protect them. Enter the car seat.
All right, and that's why you have little cute little ads like this explaining to people how to put their car seat in their own car.
Make sure the car seat is secured tightly.
No wiggle room.
Check the harness strap for tightness.
Good and tight. Oh.
Oh.
Oh, my.
Ouch. Oh. The harness clip should be at armpit level.
The fronts have armpits.
Which is a reason for us to play a really bad 80s song, Safety Dance. I mean, this is a bit of a dance here. You've got car seats. They sound like a good idea, but how does it play out in the real Freakonomics world?
All right, so here's the sad reality. If you actually look at real-world crash test data, then other data that we can talk about later if we have time, for children 2 and over. Now, for children 2 and under, there's no a car seat is a good option. It's the best option, okay?
Great.
What you don't want to do is have a mom hold a baby in the front seat. That's the worst place.
The front seat
is the worst place.
Partially because of the airbags, right?
Well, no, because there's a lot more room to hold around.
Keep going.
Now, once you put people in the back seat, whether they're grown-ups or kids, grown-ups should ride in the back seat too if you're concerned just with safety. For children 2 and over, if you look at real-world crash test data, it turns out that car seats do not provide any significant advantage for fatalities or serious injuries over just having a kid in an adult lap and shoulder belt, even though that belt is obviously not designed to fit them.
So great for the kid car seat manufacturers, but do the car seats themselves pose a hazard in some way?
No. There's nothing wrong with the car seat, except maybe you could say that, well, if the goal is to really protect children and we have the safety device that's been around for 40 years and it doesn't show that it actually protects children better than the old safety device, which is an ill-fitting seatbelt, and which NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration, tells us 80% of all car seats are improperly installed. So you take a 40-year-old safety device, 80% of the people who have strong incentive, by the way, to do it properly,
right,
i.e. parents who want to protect their kids, can't do it properly. It tells us that this safety device is not all it's cracked up to be. So if we really want to protect kids, we should think about doing something like optimizing the cheap and simple solution, the seatbelt, that already works, whether it means resizing them in the backseat, because most backseat passengers are children. Why do we have seatbelts that don't fit them? Why do we not have integrated car seats, fold-down back seats that do fit
them? Celeste said she figured out your whole Freakonomics scam this morning by saying it's simple is always better.
Right.
Period.
I mean, it seems to me that the Freakonomics prejudice is for things that are simple and cheap. Yeah. And I wanted to recite back to you an interesting statistic that you have in your book. You said, basically, we have one death for every 75 million miles driven. Or put another way, if you drove 24 hours a day at 30 miles per hour, you could expect to die in a car accident only after driving for 285 straight years. That's how safe cars really kind of are at this point. There's a lot of traffic deaths because there's a lot of people on the road.
Absolutely right. If you look at here's a really interesting number if you want to amaze your friends. 50 or 60 years ago, before the seatbelt was available at all in cars, Robert S. McNamara, by the way, the much maligned Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War, when he was at Ford before that, he was a guy who pushed for car seats. He thought safety in cars was a good idea.
Seatbelts.
Ford did not like the idea. The company did not like the idea. They said, we're going to remind people that driving is very dangerous, right? But here's what's amazing. The number of deaths and auto fatalities then, in the late 50s, was about the same as we have now. Now, if you look at the number of people who drive now and the miles we drive now, the rate of death per million miles, which is how it's measured, it has plummeted. So you're right. A lot of people die in safety in traffic accidents. Considering how many more miles are driven now, it's become astonishingly much, much safer.
I think the seatbelt because it works, but it's also cheap. And
absolutely. What's not to like about cheap and simple solutions that work?
It's still the law to use the kid car seats. I mean, so what's the takeaway here?
Do we throw away the car seats? You can't throw away your car seat because you would be arrested. What you do want to do is this. If you really care about child safety, you don't accept the status quo, that car seats, this big, bulky thing that you add on with the seatbelt, is the right way to go. What you do is you push, as we've tried to do, using data to say, hey, let's protect our kids smarter, cheaper, better. Let's talk about adjustable rear seat seatbelts. Let's talk about a 5-point harness. Let's talk about integrated fold-down car seats instead of this bulky contraption made by a third party that we try to fit into the car.
Do you think the safety dance in America is terrifyingly disconnected from statistical reality in the free economics world?
Yeah, for the most part, yeah. I mean, we write a little bit about shark attacks, how people get scared out of their gourd every couple years by the number of shark attacks, whereas in truth, the number of people who die worldwide from shark attacks is about 5 on average. You know, more people probably get run over every year by TV news vans who are going to cover the shark attacks.
That's still a serious problem, though. Those 5 people, you don't care about them at all.
Yeah, sure, I care about them. And probably they wouldn't have died in some other way if they were. But you know, for us to obsess on anomalies, which is what we in the media like to do, right? That's what news is. News is something new. New is often an anomaly. The problem is our primordial lizard brains, which we all have. We try to train them up a little bit. But the truth is that we all fixate on those anomalies and treat them as they're the norm. And they're not.
All right. I got to ask your wife tomorrow if you're going to, like, throw in the car seats into some big bonfire. And
thank
she's, like,
God
going
my
along
kids have aged
this.
Out now. Yeah, we are no longer legally bound.
No difficult questions for Stephen Dugner. Stephen Dugner, co-author of Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. Thanks.
Thank you.
All this week we've been talking to Freakonomics author Stephen Dugner. He says his theory is that what people do is a way better and more accurate measure of them as people than what they say that they do. And we're asking you the same thing. Is there a difference, first of all, between what you say and what you do, and which is a better measure of who you are? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Here's your takeaway.
His cozy relationship with the warlords, with an unsavory characters, his lax attitude about rule of law and also corruption. I think those are the things are haunting us now.
Yeah, he talks about corruption, but what does he do about corruption? That's Dr. Nadir Attash talking about Hamid Karzai. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. See ya.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.